Welcome to Clay and Iron, and I'm Dr. Bill Deagle, MD, and our special guest today is Dr. John Breeding, PhD, a psychologist. And Dr. Breeding is an activist trying to stop what I call the toxic pharmacotherapy of children and adults with these nasty SSRI drugs, the drugs of choice for psychopathic murder and horrendous crimes, suicide, et cetera, and also the horror of electroshock, which damages brains, fries neurons, and is just a, if you've seen the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, it's much worse than that. And we need to stop this ridiculousness. This is not applying proper science to the pharmacology of how the brain functions. And it's an abomination. It's an abuse of people's civil rights. And again, the testing of children, now mandatory in schools twice a year, is also trying, literally with the drug companies, to feed more and more children to the big drug industry, to literally the statement by the American Pediatric Psychiatric Association saying 20 to 25% of all children, quote, need these drugs, and how ridiculous a statement that is. So welcome to the program, Dr. John Breeding. And give us a little introduction to your foundation, your website, and what your mission is.
Okay. Well, I'm here in Austin, Texas. I'm a father with three kids and a psychologist that does a little counseling and an activist on the issues that you're talking about. I have a little group called Texans for Safe Education that's geared towards trying to protect the kids from all the labels and drugging. And then we've got another group called the Coalition for the Abolition of Electroshock in Texas, which is challenging electroshock, and specifically starting with one of the hospitals here in Austin, Seton Shoal Creek Hospital. So as you said, I'm involved in those two issues, activist and politically speaking, and then I also am one of the guys who's trying to create a little better understanding of how to support and help people and how to protect them from some of the more endangering things that are masquerade under the name of medical treatment.
And medicine, in fact, has become incredibly corrupt, especially in the last 50, 60 years, because of the transfer into the medical establishment, psychiatry in particular, of mind control technologies through Operation Paperclip from Nazi Germany and through our secret organizations like the CIA, et cetera, that have actually been fathers, if you want to call it, or proxy fathers for the big pharmaceutical drug industry through such companies as Hoffman, LaRoche, et cetera.
Well, that's the history of it. You know, it does come from nefarious sources that way, and certainly the governments have used and experimented with all kinds of mind control technology, including various drugs and electroshock, and then the modern version of that still goes on, but the modern version of it, for the most part, is the pharmaceutical company influence and the fact that they're economically and political so powerful that they kind of drive governmental policies as well as public thought through the massive media kind of campaigns.
Yeah, and of course they're marketing directly to patients too. Like, hey, if you're depressed, you need Paxil. Well, it turns out that Luvox was one of the drugs du jour of both Klebold and Harris that caused the major lawsuit there, and it was a sealed judgment against the SSRI drugs. So that people don't know this in the issue of Columbine, and in many other both issues where mothers commit horrendous crimes against their children, or other people commit suicide or violent homicidal crimes, they're under the influence of these very nasty drugs.
That's right. You know, there's a whole list of so-called senseless violence, you know, that a lot of the school shootings, including the Columbine, but a lot of other situations like Kip Kinkle in Oregon and Stephen Abrams in California, and a lot of these situations have a common denominator of derangement probably caused by the very treatments that were supposed to be called medicine, but basically these mostly SSRI drugs that you're talking about. There is a case, a pretty famous case here in Texas, of the woman Andrea Yates in Houston who was drowned several of her children, and she was in a pretty deranged condition under the influence of at least two of these SSRI drugs. So it's really gotten to the point where once you kind of start to see this, and the first question that goes through one's mind when one first reads about an incident of this so-called senseless violence in the paper is, okay, what's the drug involvement? And nine times out of ten, it'll show up that there's psychotropic drug involvement.
Yeah, it's a very remarkable association. And it's not that people don't have depression, but psychological therapy, nutritional therapies to try to change the neurotransmitter levels, other interventions dealing with the situational issues and communication, it certainly works with, and working with the physiology of the person is far superior to these nasty drugs.
Well, that's the tragedy of it. I mean, there's a lot of tragedies of it, but one of those is that, you know, there are really benign methods of loving care at both a physical and an emotional and a social level. Just what you're saying, Bill, is exactly right on, you know.
Yeah.
Part of what happens once you just sort of label somebody as biologically or genetically defective with some kind of so-called mental illness, then you kind of stop thinking or forget about, you know, the needs of the community and the needs of real physical care, you know, that can help people who are going through troubled or troubling times, which we all do. You know, that's the other thing that's scary about this, or at least why this is such massive proportions, is that life is difficult sometimes, you know, especially in a distressed world. And so, you know, it's not just that there's these mentally ill people that go off. It's that we all have hard times, you know, and we
right.
all need the support at times, you know.
Right. And, of course, it's a substitute for society actually addressing it, or the toxins are food, air, and water, like fluoride in the water that fries people's brains, aspartame, which is a neurotoxin, chlorinated sugar, which is Splenda, et cetera, and all the heavy metals in our food, air, and water, and then deficiencies of cofactors and other things to help our body convert amino acids to neurotransmitters. I know how to treat these with nutritional therapies that simply just assist the body's own physiology to convert them with, you know, trace elements of molybdenum, amino acids, cofactors, and the body just does it itself. I mean, to me, it's remarkably short-sighted to have doctors, as soon as they see a symptom, they just zap somebody on a drug. So it's not at all on the scene to have senior citizens, at least half of them, on one or more of these type of psychoactive drugs, from drugs to stop depression to drugs to help them go to sleep to drugs to wake them up so they're not demented or supposedly less demented. To me, it's very ridiculous.
Well, it's another tragic statement about our society that so many of our elders are in nursing homes in the first place, and that over half, I think, of those are on various psychotropic drugs. You know, they're either on, you know, some sort of dangerous neuroleptic type drug, you know, because somebody wants to manage their behavior and calm them down when they're frustrated or whatever, or else they're on some kind of stimulant because they're going through sadness and loss. And so, I mean, it's just unbelievable. It literally is true that over half of the elders in nursing homes are on psychotropic drugs, and it's also true that a goodly number of them end up getting electroshocked, you know, when the drugs...
They kind of become pharmacologically demented.
Don't work. And they become pharmacologically demented and literally brain damaged as
right.
a result of these treatments. It's it just becomes a heck of a deal, you know. You know, it is absolutely true, as you talk about all the time, you know, that the medical profession is really lost, you know, in terms of how to help people anymore to a large extent. I mean, obviously,
well,
it's not
been hijacked by the big drug companies, of course.
Yeah.
And rather than looking at the physiology, just when I finished my show this last hour, I did at the Nutra Medical Report on GCN Live.
Okay.
And we had Dr. Ralph Holdsworth talking about natokinase that actually reverses the increase in the enzyme activity that makes more clots, called a plasminogen activator inhibitor 1. We can do the same thing with many different conditions. Just help the body's physiology, detox the body, replace snacks in prisons or in schools and other places where people change their physiology. And, you know, it's not at all surprising when we have overstimulation of the brain with things like the very stimulating effect of monosodium glutamate or aspartame, why children now are losing their marbles. And now, of course, I saw the latest ads where President Clinton come out talking about they're going to remove all of these snacks. And so they're only going to have the sugar-free snacks in school. Well, that's extremely dangerous. And you combine that to the co-toxicity of how a lot of these kids are now being slapped on at orders from Child Protection Services that they have to take these drugs. Or, in fact, what they're threatening to do is take the children from the parents if they won't medicate their kids for attentional disorders with Ritalin and Xylert, Pemoline, Strattera, and all these other nasty drugs that cook their neurons and cause Parkinson's and other motor disorders as well as tics. And some of these tics, if you don't treat them quickly or get them off the drug, they're permanent. They get, you know, permanent tics or chorioathetosis, which is a movement disorder that does not have a normal cure unless you do stereotactic neurosurgery that's only available in a few places in the world. So it's very unacceptable to someone like myself, who's a scientist first and a doctor second, to see this foolishness going on for my profession that have lost literally their marbles.
Well, you know, once somebody becomes neurotoxic, in effect, you know, and they start showing some disturbed thinking or behavior, you know, what happens is that some neighbor or somebody expresses concern. The mental health deputies come down. They take the person, commit them to the state mental health system, state hospital or whatever, and they're labeled as having some sort of biological or genetic mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar, so-called, and they're then forced onto something like Zyprexa or something, and it's sort of this self-fulfilling kind of system that says these people are really mentally ill and they need these drugs, and it's totally nothing in place to really do the kind of legitimate kind of medical screening and care that you're talking about. It's
they're not doing metabolic screening.
I see it every day. Right before I got hold of you for this show today, the mental health deputies literally showed up outside of my office as a client was leaving because somebody had called on that person. And, you know, she is going through a very hard time, but believe me, the mental health deputies show up with a gun and just scare the living daylights out of her. And
you're really, you know, let's repeat this for the audience that may not live in America. Mental health deputies show up like the DEA with guns.
Yeah.
And what were they doing?
Yeah, because somebody called in and reported some kind of trouble at some place or that she was possibly dangerous to herself or something. Somebody was concerned and they got some calls. So they show up.
Is this a normal sheriff's deputy, or is it?
In Texas, the way it works is that the sheriff's department has what they call mental health deputies, and they're the ones who get called in on so-called psychiatric cases, and they're the ones who will make a judgment, and if their judgment is that this person is dangerous to themselves or others, then they'll take them into the psychiatric emergency services place and likely end up at the state hospital, and then they'll go for a court order to hold them for a while and force them to take their drugs and stuff. That's sort of how it works.
Yeah, once you get on these drugs.
In the United States of America, there's 1.5 million of these so-called involuntary commitments a year.
That's a lot of people going into involuntary commitment.
It's a lot of people being incarcerated and forcibly drugged.
Right. Now, since last year, let's talk about this new policy that the Bush administration put in, this twice a year testing of all children, quote, psychological testing and screening, which is mandatory. You can't opt out of it for religious or other grounds, and there are states trying to pass laws so they can opt out of it. Tell us the progress in this avenue in terms of what's happening.
Yeah, so I was describing the reality of 1.5 million adults in this country, incarcerated, you know, without a trial and that kind of thing, and forcibly drugged under the name of so-called mental illness. The another aspect that you're talking about results. I mean, this is not really a new thing. I mean, there's been historical efforts too, but the latest incarnation of it is the president's so-called New Freedom Commission, which was an appointed commission that convened and came out with their recommendations in the summer of 2003.
New Freedom. I guess New Freedom is total enslavement.
New Freedom is, yeah, right, exactly. It's a very, very Orwellian kind of use of language.
Yeah, always newspeak.
Newspeak, totally. New Freedom, and what it really means is, and they use the language of access and integration. We need access to people kids in trouble and we need to integrate services. But what it really means is we're going to go out and actively recruit and find people to label and treat. And so meaning treat, meaning drug. So one of the recommendations is for so-called universal mental health screening. That means, you know, that we get access to all the kids, you know, and all the mothers and everybody else, and go out and screen, meaning go out and look for possible signs of so-called mental illness, so that, you know, you have 50 some odd million kids in the schools, you know, you go out and screen them, and the estimate is, like, kind of like what you were saying, that you're going to find 20-25% who have troubles and might need treatment. And so,
yeah, I was actually quoting the a senior person.
Yeah, so, you know, you've already got, this is unbelievable enough, you've already got, you know, approximately maybe 15% of the school-age children in the United States on psychotropic drugs.
Right.
And that's not enough. It's never enough, because what drives it is the core values of corporate, of international corporate life, which is basically maximum profit and minimum liability, you know, so there's never enough. So 15% is enough. The product market needs to continue to grow up. So under the name of, oh, we're finding these poor mentally ill kids who need help, what's really going on is we're finding product points, you know, for our various drugs, which we managed to get into the state formularies, you know, so that as kids are recruited in, they automatically go on the main profit points for Eli Lilly or whoever.
Right. I heard that a quarter of the entire United States economy now, which is the largest economy in the world, is based on the unwellness industry, I call it, or the disease industry, which the medical profession cannot cure because it's counter to their financial model. And that's why we have things like natokinase that can stop vascular problems. But that's why we have the Fatal Drugs Allowed organization, FDA, wants to make sure that if you have a nutrient, including cranberry juice, that might prevent bladder infections, cranberries are now could be confiscated as a drug. And on the other hand, the toxic drugs are fine, even like drugs like Celebrex, Vioxx, and Bextra, because these drugs are owned by transnational corporations. So if they kill a half million extra people because of increased vascular problems and heart attack and stroke, well, those are just collateral damage. I mean, they don't see it on the profit sheets on the quarterly balance. So to me, the ethics of society has completely gone out the window, and the medical profession needs to start getting a backbone and standing up. And literally, instead of just a few whistleblowers like me that ask tough, what I call Charlie Sheen-type questions, the questions of a reasonable man or a reasonable doctor or an informed person, that, you know, why are we doing this? I mean, I don't understand it. To me, it's ridiculous, it's evil, it's stupid, and it actually compounds the problem. So how would you see that with the issues of the stopping these ridiculous drugs and also the issue of the electroshock? How serious a problem is this growing now into in our society?
Well, I mean, I appreciate that you're playing with some creative acronyms, you know, that point more to the reality of the purposes that these functions serve, like FDA, you know, that's ostensibly to protect consumers, you know, but in reality is driven by the pharmaceutical industry and their interests. So it's a huge problem, you know, and I see it very similar to you in that regard. You know, we have to do our best to help people understand that. Well, first of all, in regards to this whole sort of so-called mental illness, mental health area, you know, it's really an incredibly eye-opening kind of proposition to achieve the awareness that the whole thing is a total, as my friend Dr. Fred Bauman says, a total, complete, 100% fraud, that the whole model is fraudulent. You know, this whole model of biologically or genetically based disease entities called ADHD and bipolar, you know, and depression, and, you know, these as clinical diagnoses, these are just basically made up terms, you know, that are not legitimate medical entities in the sense that they have no objective signs that denote the disease.
They have
so-called symptoms.
Everything is polygenetic and based often on nutrient input to determine which genes are switched on. We have multiple copies. And in fact, you hit on a very important point that the public needs to know about, that the Human Genome Project was funded by the big drug companies because they wanted to find a gene to develop a drug for every known, quote, genetic polymorphism or evolved variant, so they could justify labeling not only a subclass of people that could always be available for their markets, but also to be able to set protocols up for the medical profession in the decades to come so they can totally control the public. And they've literally created an underclass now, children that are now having children. They themselves and their children are immediately considered cannon fodder for the drug industry.
Well, they are, you know, and on a practical level, you know, people need to really start just doing a very basic distinction between fact and opinion, you know, and understand that a lot of things that are presented as fact, such as that ADHD is a neurological disorder, that you know, or that depression is a chemical imbalance, and that these drugs treat it, you know, is like that. People need to be able to start looking and say, okay, where's the evidence of that? You know, where's the lab test that shows me what's going on and how this is treating it? And these things exist for other branches of medicine, like if you want to find the malignant tumor, you know, or the pancreatic and insulin production and blood sugar issues with diabetes or whatever. But
in
psychiatry, it's strictly just subjective opinions about somebody's behavior, and then it's all these conclusions. And so,
yeah, they've got a hierarchy, like the DSM-T4 modified book, which has become a manual literally driven by the drug industry. And they create all these subcategories with criteria that are based on a series of opinions upon opinions.
They're just opinions about people's behavior.
Yeah, and it becomes literally a new way for the, if you want to call it the newspeak, of the control to turn everything into disease. In fact, believing that the drug companies may be actually putting profits as their primary motive could be considered a new form of mental illness that could be treatable by pharmacotherapy.
Yeah, because if you're a parent, you know, or whoever, and you're looking, and they say, okay, I want to screen your child for a possible mental illness and whatever, you know, and what's really going on is I want to screen your child, you know, and we're going to have very, very, very narrow and rigid normative behavior, and if it's outside of that behavior, we're going to call that a mental illness, and we're going to use a powerful drug, you know, to so-called treat it. But what's really going on is we're just choosing kids out based on narrower and narrower definitions of normal behavior, and we're going to drug them, you know. Then you get into some ethical considerations, you know, because really it's really strictly a social and ethical kind of issue, you know, that is masquerades as a medical issue, you know.
Exactly.
And it's a medical issue, then let's address it in medical ways, like what you're talking about, you know.
Yeah.
You see, okay, if there's something really going on medically, then we're talking about an objective science that's going to look at real physical, physiological and whatever indicators. We're not going to talk about, we're just looking at your behavior and calling it a disease. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's similar to saying the child continues to run around. So what they do is a surgical procedure, which is cut off the legs.
Yeah.
That's about as logical as it is.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I'm brave enough to actually
stand
up.
The central nervous system and the, you know, with a powerful drug.
Yeah, what's disturbing is I really appreciate scientists like yourself and humanitarians like yourself that stand up and say, you're brave enough to actually say, you know, the emperor has no clothes, that the system is illogical, insane, evil, and self-serving, and doesn't have the best interests in the public in mind. And then when you say that, and for example, I was trained personally by Dr. Ewan Cameron, who was on loan from Montreal University McGill.
You were trained by him?
Yes, I was trained in
the
early 70s. He was visiting Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Oh my goodness.
And he actually gave us a number of lectures, and he actually showed us his pictures of his control rooms where they're doing deprivation experiments, etc. So I had personal training, so I know right from the horse's mouth exactly how these people were doing this stuff. And they were doing shock therapy, emotional, they're trying to completely deprogram people by disorienting them, by sensory deprivation, using all kinds of drugs. And in fact, all of the drugs, including these very nasty psychedelic drugs like LSD were actually biological experiments carried out by the CIA. The drug LSD was, of course, researched with people like Timothy Leary from the National Security Agency, who popularized it. But they were also doing experiments at places like in Denver at the Federal Center. Their plan was to use it as a disorientation AV drug, so they'd spray it over, let's say, a boat and then disorient everybody, and then they could board it and take it over in the... And these research went back into the 50s and the 40s. And it all came directly out of Operation Paperclip, bringing over Nazi scientists working on drugs to alter the brain chemistry. Later, those scientists went to the Gulag Archipelago, where they experimented not only on American service people that were brought to these prison systems, but also people that were brought in with Operation Keel Haul that weren't killed immediately by under President Eisenhower, that we literally as Americans shipped back over across the Iron Curtain. But also a lot of these experiments were later developed drugs like haloperidol and so on, which were completely funded by operations through the CIA. I mean, all of these drugs were brought forward by these agencies as mind control drugs and later became drugs du jour for the psychiatrists.
Well, I'm very interested in this concept of so-called Dostoevsky, I think, called it Blutkit, but it means blood cement, you know, and it's the idea that, you know, you get the four members of a gang to do in a fifth, and they're bonded together by blood cement, and I think of a lot of professional training that way, in the sense, for example, if you have a medical doctor do a rotation in an electroshock unit, and you get them to start doing electroshock, and pretty soon they're sort of in a position where they have to kind of ethically somehow, but they sort of have to justify and qualm their conscience about that some way, and it makes it hard for them to look at the horrible reality of it. I don't know if Cameron ever had you actually going through apprenticeships or whatever, how you
sort of... No, I went, I did my medical school there, and I went to Vancouver for my internal medicine training.
Uh-huh.
But he had all kinds of information he showed us. He was a senior visiting professor.
Okay.
And it gives us an idea how much, and people don't realize this, but 96% of all science, whether it's medical, physics, chemistry, et cetera, is all classified and compartmentalized, and it's not available even to the PhDs at university level. And only when you get literally recruited into a specific, very compartmentalized division of the military-industrial corporate complex globally into these organizations, do you ever get access to these other things? And all of these other technologies, including the drugs, are literally leaked spin-offs of this advanced research on brain control or other aspects.
Well, you know, Pat Cameron was doing that annihilation kind of stuff, just destroying people, you know. But, you know, you know, in New York, there, just below, and up there where you are, I guess, you know, we have a couple of the lawyers that are on our legal advisory team for our electroshock coalition are lawyers there in New York, and they work in the on some cases in the so-called mental health system there, and they are currently in court on a case where a woman's already received about 200 forced electroshocks, and they want a court order another 50. So this is a woman who's already received about 200. She doesn't want them. They want a court order another 50 or so. And the lawyers are trying to get got temporary stay on it, and they're trying.
Isn't
to
that
get
amazing?
Get
and they don't
just cause today. This is still going on. You know,
oh yeah,
at least
I'm sure
in New York, you know.
Yeah.
In Texas, they can't do forced electroshock anymore because we got a law passed, but they still shock a lot of people.
It's a remarkable thing too is the effects from this type of treatment are it fries brain neurons.
Yeah.
It causes damage to the brain and the central nervous system, and because of oxidative damage, it increases the risk of brain tumors and cancer.
That's right.
And so these people will later on develop things like organic dementias. They develop problems with motor disorders, and they develop higher risk of getting primary brain tumors in their brain caused by this type of treatment.
Yeah, it's basically sending 150 volts or more of electricity directly into the brain through the temporal lobes, generally, and so, you know, it's very obviously, you know, obviously going to cause brain damage, and you describe some of the specific ways, and yet this is considered a a big tool in the sort of psychiatric arsenal or whatever. You know, it's basically the backup treatment to the drugs. It's estimated about 100,000 people a year in the United States get this so-called treatment. It's unbelievable.
It is really. And, of course, the bigger problem with SSRI drugs, and I'm going to quote one of our senior psychiatrists teaching at a review course for board recertification I did 3 years ago, because we had to do it every so many years.
Okay.
And he actually quoted and said, well, the Japanese are developing a drug that works the exact opposite way of these SSRI drugs, and it seems to work from their research so far. He said, but, you know, we really don't know how these drugs work. It's like kicking the back of your 1960s TV set. I'm thinking, so I asked him a question. I said, well, if you don't know how they work, why are we using them?
Yeah, the truth is that the mechanism of if you really pin it down regarding any of these psychotropic drugs, the mechanism of action is unknown. Is the
right
answer that you'll get? You know, it's unbelievable, and yet these are presented and they're touted to the public as if they're sort of like a smart bomb or something. You know, I mean, we know, you know, it goes in and it affects this little serotonin receptor and blah blah blah.
Oh, yeah,
but the reality is the mechanism of action is unknown.
Exactly. They'll say this interacts with 5-HT1 receptor, increases neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft. It's going to do this and that. And then all of a sudden they say, well, if it changes the enzyme within hours, how come it takes 4 to 6 weeks for them to improve, at least clinically, even if you, what I call putting bars on their mind? Because I don't think it changes the physiology. I think it actually does something where the body is trying to adapt to this toxin.
Mm.
And externally things change, but internally, their chemistry is way out of balance. I mean, and we know that these drugs change other nuclei and parts of the brain, the rage control center, the ability to think rationally, so they become have psychotic breaks where they are no longer in contact with reality. It becomes extremely dangerous when you have people like Andrea Yates, who does something horrendous to all of her children, and later on is completely not aware that this was them under the influence of these very dangerous drugs.
Well, they're definitely brain disabling and treatments, and you know, we got to just keep pounding the point that, you know, it's a pseudoscience, and there's no demonstrated disease in the first place in these decisions that are made, and
yeah,
you know, as long as you're buying into the fact that this is medicine for people's illnesses, you know, you're susceptible to this. Oppressive kind of dynamic.
Well, I give you an example. I just got a call a few days ago, because I consult all over the world trying to help health professionals, teach people, and also patients that call me and say, you know, hey, I just have this issue or that issue. And I just had an off-the-cuff call. It wasn't even a consult, to say, oh, well, I'm having tremendous headaches and I'm getting very depressed. My doctor's talking about putting me on Paxil. I said, well, how do you eat and drink? Well, I drink like 6 or 8 aspartame-containing cola-type drinks every day. I'm saying, well, the first thing you need to do is stop the toxins.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that, then all of a sudden you may not have headaches, and the depression, quote, may go away. And as soon as they did that, literally the depressive symptoms and the headaches went away.
Mm.
Some of these people can get nasty withdrawal, too, because they literally are craving it, because these are toxins, and people often crave toxins.
Mm-hmm.
But I measure things like in the urine neurotransmitter levels. You can measure cofactors. You can measure objectively things that are balanced, but it's so simple to correct it. You just give the right amino acids, the right cofactors, and the body's enzyme just converts it. You do not ever need to give these drugs. And I know we just had MI3 come out, and I agree with his statement. I know he's taken an awful lot of flack over it, talking about the Mission Impossible 3. Because I really think that it is an example of many, many procedures, not just these psychiatric, but medical procedures. For example, in the area of spinal surgery, I see people with spinoplasties done at the drop of a hat.
Mm.
And it's the same kind of thing. Very no good science, but yet they do it. The approach toward therapies for AIDS, instead of changing the whole way we approach age, it turns out that they've estimated half of the people that die don't die of the AIDS virus at all. They die of the drug therapies, because we need to take a new tact and a new way of approaching these. And in fact, if anything, our treatments are increasing multi-drug resistance. But it's many areas like this that are completely lack a scientific basis, and as a result, we don't get the effect we expected. But the profession just plows on, and you're right, they have this blood cement type thing where the medical profession obviously it's anathema to blow the whistle on your colleagues that are doing stupid things.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, we're talking to these shock doctors here in Austin to influence them to stop what they're doing, but the reason why, you know, we're having to go public and all this is basically because there is just no accountability. There's no ability for that profession to police itself. I mean,
no,
how else do you explain the fact that, you know, you've got 200 electroshocks, you're court ordering 50 more. None of the medical profession is saying anything about that, you know?
No. And the thing is that you ask them, I'll get some science. I mean, it's like when they did lobotomies. They had, you know, traveling lobotomy vans back 40, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people still around in these institutions are people who are the subjects of ridiculous criteria for having the surgery done literally in a traveling van.
Yeah, it's not that long ago, you know, 50 years ago, you know, a lobotomobile going around and taking the second eye specs in people's eyes to cut their, what do you call it, orbital lobe or whatever. And that's how primitive it was. And the truth is that electroshock is a little more high tech because you got a machine and you're putting electricity in there, you know, but it's still about that primitive, you know.
Yeah, it's cooking nerves by literally microwaving them by super high voltages and frying nerve pathways.
Yeah, and that's a medical treatment, you know?
Yeah, well, it's about as medical as the current non-lethal, by definition, kills less than 25% of the people that exposes use of microwave, high-frequency and ELF technologies over in Fallujah, Najaf, and other places in Iraq. And again, people say, well, no, they can't do that. Yes, they have. And I've had Dr. Nick Begich on the program. I have other experts that have got all kinds of Freedom of Information Act literature. And these kinds of technologies are available. And the problem that I see is that our medical profession, you know, hopefully they won't take the step to even institute some of these kinds of technologies to control, to use crowd control literally on their, quote, psychiatric population. But it's the same level of insanity as using electronic means to control the population as electroshock and these crazy drugs. You know, why do they think they see these kinds of crimes in young mothers? You know, I'm now hearing more stories, horror stories, where mothers are literally required to take these drugs, you know, because of, quote, the danger of postpartum depression. And this is a particularly dangerous time when you give these SSRI drugs.
I agree.
And they really go over the edge. I mean, it's extremely dangerous. You can't leave them alone for a few minutes when you give them the SSRI drugs. And
definitely some women's issues, you know. I really want women to snap to this. You know, there's that whole issue around postpartum depression, so-called, you know, the pathologizing of kind of hormonal and physical and, you know, dynamics that happen for some women, especially when they're kind of depleted after birth. And
right, then they have to
that, you know,
find out what they are.
The thing about menopausal experience, most of the women that get electroshocked, you know, are of menopausal age, and there's all kinds of sort of lack of awareness and misinterpretation and lack of care for things that could really support women, you know, during that time.
Yeah, proper supportive group therapy, personal therapy, nutritional counseling, lifestyles, detoxification, natural bioidentical hormone support, which, of course, is under attack. They've even tried to outlaw progesterone in California and considered a toxic cancer-inducing drug, which is insane because it's a natural hormone present in the bodies. And if you don't have it, you get PMS. So I see more and more of this foolishness going on to remove natural foods and natural things that are in the environment that are part of what makes us healthy and to turn them into toxins. And then the toxic things get called good. I mean, you know, it's good that we give those kids, Xylard or Pemoline or Strattera, which literally cooks their neurons and can give them a tic de la rue or some other weird, one of these tic syndromes where they've got you know, they're cursing and swearing because a certain nuclei in their brain are being stimulated.
Yeah, bad is good and good is bad. It's totally
yeah.
Newspeak, like you say, you know, that this is good for the child to take his medicine, which is basically, you know, an addictive substance that's virtually identical to cocaine and its effects profile, you know, or something like cocaine, like Ritalin or Adderall, you know, or it's good for them to take these drugs so-called antidepressants that cause oftentimes suicidal or agitative kind of dynamics, and definitely cause, if you take them for a while, kind of a reformation or deformation of various brain functions. I mean, it is just really, really pathetic. And
it is. It's incredible. And in fact, I'm thinking about that. Our international toll-free 800 number, that's 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227.
Yeah,
and you can call and ask
questions
to Dr. Breeding.
Comments. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I'll repeat that number as we go through our program. Let's deal with some of the current things you're doing in your website. What's your website address?
Well, I've got a couple of websites I want to mention. My website with my personal work and stuff is wildestcolts.com. It's like the wildest colts make the best horses, which is one of my books. WILDESTCOLTS, wildestcolts.com.
Wildestcolts, and of course, that implies the issue that maybe some of these children are kind of high energy, so you don't just medicate that high energy out of them. You try to direct it. You try to work with the way that they learn and so on, rather than trying to turn them into something that they're not.
Yeah, that's right. The wildest colts make the best horses. Spirited young people make spirited adults. You know, the alternative from the biomedical, biopsychiatric point of view is more like poor, sick, defective young children need drugs to cope with their life, you know.
Yeah, well, they're actually creating an underclass. In fact, this is a segue into another topic that I know there will be another cause celeb that we need to deal with, is the whole issue of the psychotronic vaccines that have been developed through Operation BioShield in conjunction with Britain. And they're now going to be testing them this year with DPS, the Department of Public Services, and CPS in America. Which actually create plaque in certain nerve pathways by blocking certain neurotransmitters so that they can actually block your ability to, quote, get addicted to alcohol, cigarettes, cocaine, heroin, et cetera. But they also turn you into a zombie as a side effect because you don't have normal excitement when you score that goal or you do well on the test and you don't have any more passion. You literally become a useless and non-motivated zombie.
Well, it's just, I mean, that's very, very sad, and it's very, very dangerous, you know, talk about mind control. You're really talking about just systematic brain damage, you know.
Yeah, it's systematic and targeted nanotechnology to create damage to specific nerve pathways to convert people literally from human beings into human machines.
Wow.
And I draw this out not to create a sense of terror on the part of people, but for them to wake up and say no. Just like when we have Pastor Butch Pah on my programs, both on the Nutri-Medical Report, and I have experts like Nick Begich saying no to the national ID driver's license, no to these darn drugs, no to electroshock, no to psychotronic vaccines that can affect your nerve pathways, no to these neurotoxins like aspartame, Splenda, and all the other toxins they're adding, like genetically modified frankenfoods that cook our brains and cause abnormal development. And
well, I agree, you know, to really say yes to life in the really positive, magnificent sense of the word, you have to say about 99 no's for every yes. So there's definitely
exactly
a place to say a lot of no's, you know.
And there's solutions to all these problems. I mean, I think there's no such thing as a problem that we can't solve. And I really think the problem we have now is that people have been dumbed down and felt that they're disenfranchised to the point where they can't say anything for fear of losing their jobs if they're in a profession like medicine or law. And so they won't speak up. And they should realize that there will be no future for any of us if we don't speak up. So if there's doctors listening, whether you're in America or overseas, if there's lawyers, if you're a health professional, go back and evaluate the science behind this. What you'll find is, in fact, lies.
That's right.
You'll find out that they don't have science. For example, are they measuring neurotransmitters? Are they doing fMRI, functional MRI? Are they doing SPECT or PET scan, quantitative EEG? Do they do neurophysiological studies to indicate what is happening? Many of the behaviors we're seeing are due to the high intake of sugars, which are stimulants to children in these vending machines and lunches. They're having high intake of genetically modified foods now, soy, et cetera. They've depleted materials in their soils and foods in very, very rigid and non-nourishing diets that are nutrient poor. And then they expect these kids to have normal behavior and neurotransmitter levels, when it's not a genetic problem. It's nutritional, environmental, and behavioral. And the solution is not going to be found in another pill or a surgical procedure or electroshock.
That's right.
And it's not a simple solution, but it means pull the damn vending machines from these schools, stop the garbage lunches, stop the GMO food and aspartame and other additives that are, you can't, as I say, if you can't pronounce it, don't eat it.
That's good advice, you know. By the way, the other website I wanted to mention regarding the electroshock is pretty simple. It's endofshock.com.
Endofshock.com. That's a great, simple website.
That's our website for the.
And of course, they can donate to your causes. They can get involved in their state or country.
Get in touch with us. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, America sets the tone for many other countries, which often adopt the thing. So when the FDA adopted aspartame, the other countries didn't even do their own independent research, and as a result, the toxins and the other things spread all over the world. And it's often American transnational corporations, which acts as a platform to launch these things everywhere. And vice versa, as we stop electroshock in America, it'll stop in America, Australia, Britain, and elsewhere.
Our work at home is never ending. I mean, you know, we're the main exporter of violence and aggression in the world by far, and we're the prime mover and shaker of pharmaceutical poisons. You know, we're the one country in the world that drugs a very high percentage of our children. You know, it really is about being willing to speak, even if it's with a shaky voice.
Right.
You know, what you said about, you know, just say, okay, you know, we all have some fear because we live in a fear-mongering kind of world and society, you know. But, you know, we really, really do have to speak up. And when you look at the heart of a child, you know, that or the heart of anyone you care about, you know, that's a pretty good motivation to
right.
stand up and make a noise.
Well, the problem I see too is that these drugs that are SSRIs are extremely dangerous. We compare them to the treatment, say, for example, of chronic pain, which is opioids in the hands of doctors who are giving long-acting drugs. They're not dangerous at all if they're used properly and monitored, etc. Whereas these SSRI drugs are incredibly dangerous. And to me, it's the most insane situation, and it's caused by cowardliness on the part of the scientists and the doctors. And this is the latest twist. I don't know if you've heard of this, Dr. Breeding, but the insurance carriers now have been lobbying and getting their way on with the CMS, et cetera, that they're now setting up protocols, and they're setting up what's called standards of care and using the substandard medical practice as a way of disciplining doctors. So here's what happens. They audit the doctor's practice for their data. They data mine. And the doctor has to report patients who refuses to take psychoactive drugs when there's certain diagnostic codes or things in their history. That's why they're all pushing toward a completely transparent electronic medical record.
Mm-hmm.
And then if the patients are reported by the doctor and they don't follow treatment, they can be deinsured or rated by the insurance carrier. And if the doctor does not report them after they data mine, then they can be disciplined by the state licensing authorities, and are now starting to move cases forward to discipline doctors as substandard medical care because they don't act as a cop doc and actually report their patients beyond the confines of normal patient-doctor privacy. And so that's what's happening. We're literally moving to where doctors are completely cowed by insurance carriers and by the Medicare, Medicaid, CMS establishment. And this is a very, very dangerous move. We're now moving completely to the Dr. Mengele-type medicine.
Well, I know a little bit about that from listening to you before, Bill. But I tell you, you know, that's been going along in my profession forever. That's the basis of psychiatry, and that's the one place that historically psychiatry has been very different from regular medicine, you know, which has been pretty much voluntary and private and confidential, at least historically, and it's been a little confused more and more with all the HMO stuff and all that, but at least in principle it's supposed to be that it's a voluntary thing, it's a confidential relationship like that, whereas in psychiatry, you know, there's always the threat of, you know, in fact, it's considered an ethical obligation of so-called mental health professionals, you know, that if you consider someone to be dangerous to themselves or others, and that's pretty loosely determined, just according to your sort of opinion about whether the person is able to care for themselves in a way that you think is right, you know, then it's your duty to turn them in and have them incarcerated against their will and forcibly treated against their will. And, you know, that's the way it works. So in essence, you know, and it gets really clear when you look at, like, Child Protective Services and all that, and you have therapists who are paid by the state or ostensibly representing a client, but their obligation is to report back to the government. So you have all these situations basically where the counselor or the therapist or whatever you want to call them, you know, the professional providing services to a client is really acting as an agent of the state, and that's the way it's set up. It's really,
yeah, I call it the
problem.
Matrixification of medicine.
You call it, say that again?
The matrixification, turning the entire medical process.
So more medicine is becoming
into
more
literally
like
the control matrix, the complete control matrix.
Well, yeah. So, you know, we definitely need to, and what I'm trying to do, is, of course, is push psychiatry the other direction, and definitely you need to resist the rest of medicine going along with that. You know, people need to know, you know, be clear about where their loyalties are, you know, and you need to know. It's like if you go to school, you know, and you really trust your teacher, well, maybe you can trust that person as an individual, but you better, as a parent, know that, you know, that no matter what's going on, that teacher is a government agent. They're working for the government schools, and that's
right.
Just paying them, you know. And so, same thing, you know, if you have a doctor that is really, in effect, accountable to the government more than they are to you, you know, you need to know that.
Yeah, that's a very big problem, and that's what I'm saying is happening with CMS, with Medicare, Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing in state and federal, and then the insurance carriers, they're basically completely, you know, holding the purse strings, and also with these protocols, moving toward not just in psychiatry, which has been like this for a long time, but moving toward everything, and of course feeding data into the system so that not just the doctor is the one initiating the whole process of a diagnostic, you know, label, but the school system, the school psychologists, the, you know, the teachers. Where I've actually had teachers, you know, confront me and say, you know, hey, this kid's hyperactive, get him on medicine. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And the schools won't even accept them back in unless they're medicated.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we
and
of
course they've had...
legislature here to handle that, and because we were seeing so much of it, you know, the schools would threaten the parents, and then if they didn't go along with it, they'd call the government in the form of Child Protective Service agencies and accuse the parents of medical neglect. You know, it took a lot to kind of back them off, you know, in our state, but it still goes on.
On in other states where they actually will seize the children even. There's cases that around the country and in other countries like Canada and elsewhere, Britain, where they seize the children from the parents if they won't medicate them.
If they won't medicate them, yeah. So that's illegal here now, but it's happening, you know, and you know, and again, our point of view on now is just that, you know, this is not like a neglect of treating a child's or responding to a child's epileptic seizure condition or whatever, you know.
Or
it's basically
or
just
something.
A difference of opinion about whether you want to drug a child for their behavior, you know. And so it comes back to our original saying of saying, you know, let's not be confused about what is the difference between a real disease in someone's opinion about your behavior, you know, and when the society is in a place where it's systematically coercing people for their behavior, you know, then what you're really talking about is social control and a kind of a political oppression kind of dynamic, and let's call it what it is.
Yeah, exactly. It's to me, it's quite remarkable that these things go on without people correctly labeling them. And, you know, if I had known when I went into medical school back in 1973 that in 2006 I would see my profession going down this road, I would have said, no, you're crazy. That couldn't possibly happen. And although I went through training and saw these things and said, that's pretty horrendous. I'm not going to ever get involved in that. When I saw these little slideshows from Dr. Ewan Cameron talking about his, you know, total isolation, his plans for reprogramming people, putting to a state of, you know, basically wiping the slate is how he described it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is very scary stuff. We're talking about, you know, Nazification of medicine. And, they, you know, the people say, oh, they think that's exaggerated to say that. I said, no. Many of the, quote, scientific, quote, advances, they call, came from the Nazi death camps and their experiments, not only on Jews, but on Slavs and many of their own people. It's very scary stuff. And that's why we need to look back into the ethics of this whole issue and the science of it, and it doesn't hold water in either count. You know, and what I see is a more stressful society, so we see more people in distress, whether it's due to, you know, social distress or biochemical distress or toxic distress. And instead of us solving the problems, what we do is we say, oh, we've got to put them on another pill. It's not because they're suffering electromagnetic pollution, because the child is a teenager and they're on the cell phone at 1,100 minutes a month or 2,000 minutes a month. And they're cooking their brains, and they're eating Diet Coke, and they're eating sugar candy, and they're hyperactive, and they don't eat proper meals, and they miss breakfast. It's, oh, we need to medicate this child with two or three drugs because of their acting out behavior. And I think the whole thing is ridiculous.
Well, I agree.
So what kind of action steps can we take to deal with this in our state or province in Canada or our country, you know, around the world, because many of these things are becoming now standard fare in other countries as well, and we're trying to export this technology just as the DEA exported the war against drugs.
Well, a lot of it is just, I mean, you know, one of my favorite book titles is called My Name is Chellis and I'm in Recovery from Western Civilization. And, you know, it kind of reinforces the point that you were making that, you know, we do live in a highly stressful and toxic world, and, you know, both at a physical and emotional and mental level and electronic level and everything else. And you know, it's a difficult thing for adults to stand up and really confront that and take full responsibility for it. And that's really what we're talking about, is just becoming responsible, you know, to really see reality and to do things for it. And so in terms of our children, that means we do have to protect them from a lot of things, you know, like the unnecessary immunizations and the psychotropic drugs and the hours of TV and video and the junk foods. And there's just a number of things that the culture pushes on kids that we as parents have to stand up and protect our kids from. And then the other part is that we have to go beyond that and know that if we're really going to have a viable future, you know, that's moving in a positive direction at all, we not only have to just protect our own child, but we also have to do what we can to impinge on things and to create some positive alternatives and to really kind of put a little more pressure on the accountability and on bringing systems and professions, you know, like medicine, back towards some common sense, you know.
Yeah, for example, get some evidence-based testing like MEG, which is magnetic encephalography, quantitative EEG, neurotransmitters, functional MRI, other tests, and start doing actual studies to say, oh, what's going on here? Remove toxins, detoxify children that have got lead. They're asking us in cities like Denver to do zwitter ion protein levels for lead poisoning. Even though it was removed from gasoline in the 70s, the dust blows around all the U.S. cities and towns every day, and children are still toxic from lead.
Yeah. Let's just not throw drugs at people. Let's find, because we don't like what's going on or because we think they're having a hard time. Let's figure out what's going on. You know, a lot of times all it is that the adults just need to chill out and get a little bit more relaxed, you know, but sometimes there really is something going on, but let's not.
Yeah, exactly.
Do that
just hyperactive kids
of it.
And the parent doesn't want to bother with a child that's high energy that's going to be demanding.
you know, and people are stressed and they're tired, but, you know, the truth is, I like this saying that, I mean, there's the wildest colts make the best horses, and then there's this other saying by this guy named Paul Valéry that a difficulty is a sun, an insurmountable difficulty is a light. No, I'm sorry, a difficulty is a light, an insurmountable difficulty is a sun. You know, so it's saying instead of, you know, making this judgment that this energetic, strong-willed child or whatever is a pathology, let's look and say, this is a powerful being that is not going to conform to my will. You know, this person is not coming into the world for me to control and dominate their life. You know, I'm going to have to figure out how to be in relationship with this being who is a force, you know. And that has more to do with my taking responsibility for myself and, you know, letting go of my idea that I'm the one who's determining the course of this person's life. I mean, I'm going to do my best to provide some guidance and support and appropriate limits and those kind of things. But mostly I'm going to just be kind of like, wow, this being is a son, and it's my job to protect and nourish and do whatever I can to keep society off the young person's back enough so that they can become at least one more powerful young adult and adult who can totally question authority and totally stand up and say the kind of things that you and I are saying on this show, you know?
Yeah, in fact, that should be a part of the education system, but with Goals 2000 and without specific curriculum and so on, what we're seeing is a move toward what I call thought crime. Basically, thinking independently is considered a non-academic process. And questioning authority, even in a dialogue or a dialectic that's more rational, is often considered not acceptable.
Yeah. I mean, the educational system was designed, you know, in the Prussian-German model, you know, to create good workers and soldiers, and it's pretty effective at that, you know. We're pretty good at producing large pools of people who can't think real independently, who'll go along and take whatever job they can get, and who'll be available to be so-called loyal to the country, no matter what kind of nefarious crimes the country is committing in the name of their military. And so there's always, you know, there's a pool of that, you know, and that's the reality of how you set up an educational system that does not support self-directed learning and sustained involvement with projects, but it has this 45-minute bells and this totally designated curriculum that doesn't allow for any independence and initiative. And I mean, that system was not designed as a fluke. It didn't come across by accident, and it was not designed in terms of teaching how children learn. It was designed for a specific purpose, which was to create good workers and soldiers, and it's good at that.
Yeah, it tries to create what I call unidimensional intellects that basically can absorb and regurgitate but not critically think, that some of the information they have is cognitively dissonant with other information or doesn't make logical sense when you compare the two sources of information that they've even been taught. And as a result, it's easy to rewrite history, as I guess they say in the novel 1984, when the last documents have been changed and altered, then history itself has been modified.
My favorite historian, one of my favorite historians is Howard Zinn, and he always likes to say, you know, if you're not able to know history, then it's you live like you were born yesterday. You know?
That's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good one. You know, because it just means that, you know, you don't, you know, all there is is you're born yesterday, and today is the president saying that there's this evil guy and we need to go take him out. You know, you don't realize that there's always been evil guys that we're supposed to take out for some justification. You know, and that there's, you know, and that there's this history and that history and history, and every one of them is a bad ending. You know?
Yeah, I know. Well, of course, all of it is a play act, and we've been duped at every level. And dealing with the whole history of psychiatric illnesses, what kinds of things do you offer, say, the young person now, the young disoriented teenager? What kinds of services do you offer in Texas to help someone as a template for elsewhere in the country and other countries?
Yeah. Well, so again, part of it is that there are no real psychiatric illnesses.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying, what do you offer? Let's say someone's having an issue,
yeah,
and they've
right.
been labeled
so,
with a name,
yeah.
and they, let's say, you intervene and finally get a hold of this child. how do you kind of start dissecting away the onion layers of whatever they've done, not only labeling, but also changing the person's self-image.
Right. Well, with children,
and their relationships.
With children, the fundamental, most important part, frankly, is with the adults around, you know, so that, one, you really have to be effective, you really have to make, the adults really have to be pretty clear about that this is not a medical issue. And if it is, you don't go to a psychiatrist, you go to a medical doctor and find out if something's going on medically.
But yeah, like hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism,
that, yeah.
Or something else.
If there's something going on, but if it's just a matter of behavior and stuff, it's not a medical issue, and it's and so you really have to get pretty clear and strong that, you know, I'm not pathologizing this, you know.
Yeah.
So then you and I'm going to take a pretty high responsibility for my state of mind, you know, so that if I am, you know, wanting to kill that child, you know, it's less about the child's behavior than it is about my own stress and frustration levels or whatever, and I got to take responsibility for that. So there really is this part that, you know, the relevant adults, you know, need to take a pretty good responsibility. Beyond that, it's called, okay, well, let's look then and see what's going on, and let's be holistic about it, you know. If there is something going on physically, let's look at it. Let's look at, are they getting enough sleep, you know. Are they overstimulated with, you know, TV and video and et cetera, you know? Are they well nourished, you know? Are they getting a bunch of, you know, toxic substances in their diet? You know, those kind of practical things that you've been talking about, as well
yeah.
as if there is really something going on otherwise at a physical level. At an emotional level with children, to young children especially, what you're really looking at is connection. In relationship, you know, if connection and relationship is disrupted, then children experience distress. You know, that's just the way it is. So
yeah, a big move. To, you know, the old adage of anything, even if it's positive externally, can be a stressor that can change behavior.
Yeah, a lot of kids have a hard time with big moves and transitions, but and then also within the relationships, you know, if there's hurts and frustrations and cutoffs, you know, there has to be that kind of restoration of warmth and closeness and affection, because if children don't have that, you know, they're going to have trouble having their attention on school-related tasks or whatever, because they're going to be experiencing some emotional turmoil. So you work on that, you know. It's a lot of it's just allowing feelings and supporting the hurts to come out. A lot of it is getting back in good affectionate communication. At a mental level, you know, educational level, a lot of kids experience a hard time because, you know, they haven't picked up the learning flows or learned to read, write, or something. And so, you know, you have to address that and make.
In other words, they've not done a proper assessment of the deficiencies that reduce their ability to become competent at higher levels of many learning processes. So, our educational system doesn't do that.
So by the time a child is second grade or whatever, they're already labeled learning disabled. They're starting to get frustrated, you know, and so, you know, I mean, if a child doesn't get the basic reading and phonics things down, you know, then you got behavior problems on down the line, you know.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Again, every child is unique, and you just have to look at these levels and be willing to be an investigator about it until you figure out what's going on. A lot of the times, it really just boils down to one, just kind of remembering that there are these tremendous variations in temperament and expressivity, and so the more, when you narrow that more and more and say normal child behavior is just looks like this, then you got this whole creation of abnormals that is false. You know, really, it's just that's just a particularly energetic child. Or that's just a child that's particularly introspective, you know, and is not the social butterfly that you want your child to be, you know. So a lot of it is just creating more kind of tolerance and acceptance and relaxation around diversity. You know, a lot of what gets diagnosed as ADHD and stuff like that is just, it's just normal variations in temperament, you know. So
yeah,
it's a
exactly. Yeah.
Of those
so,
things.
And of course, those normal variations are something we should celebrate rather than destroy. It's like we want to make sausages out of every child that goes into the educational system.
Yeah.
We see that in the professions. I remember years ago seeing an actual documented study at McGill University where they found that the IQ of doctors going into medical school dropped 8 points on exit of medical school at graduation. These are graduating doctors that had, you know, good marks. And the reason for it is, I found this interesting, is that if you get a serious concussive injury, then we have these classifications for serious concussions where people get neurological disorientation, you know, visual problems, they're unconscious for so many minutes and so on.
Right.
And they're told they can't be involved with any kind of contact sports for so many months. But if you have two serious concussions like that, you get generally a 4-point drop in high and measurable IQ after each one. So going through medical school is twice as serious as two serious head injuries or concussions. So it gives you an idea of exactly the kind of foolishness that goes on to regiment people so that they can't think straight.
Wow.
And we see that in, and I say that literally tongue-in-cheek, but that's an actual study I'm quoting.
Yeah.
Because we have this kind of situation going on, and it needs to stop. We need to return to some, you know, the Cox postulates, the scientific method, evidence-based, and also a holistic approach. Look at the entire, I call it the four T's of a lifestyle, toxic relationships, toxic diet, and then toxins general in the environment, electromagnetic toxins. Pollutants in the world now is electromagnetic. Kids are sitting by computers. They're surrounded by electrical wires.
Mm.
They have electronic headsets on all the time. And literally, these headsets and these wires act as antennas to pull in radiation to their brain. They're eating toxic drinks, GMO food, minerally depleted soils, and then we wonder why they have neurotransmitter levels that are taking those innate kind of characterological slight variations and amplifying to the point where they, quote, develop socially unacceptable behavior to those who are very rigid or have establishments like a school where everyone has to behave at a certain level, or it disrupts class control.
Well, yeah, and that's another reason. And so another aspect of that, I was just thinking about listening to you, you know, is that, you know, it's our responsibility as adults as much as we can within the circumstances that our lives involve, you know, to make sure that our young people get opportunities and encouragement to spend as much time as possible outdoors and in the free space, you know, to move and run and play, but
yeah,
you know, to just be in that natural environment that we involved in and that people thrive in. And so time outdoors and time in the natural world and downtime from all the stimulating activities is crucial, you know. We get sort of addicted to stimulation and entertainment all the time, and so what I talk about is that there's this phenomenon of downtime and that when you start to create that, you know, where you just don't allow the family to immediately turn on the TV or immediately go into the computer or immediately do this, you go through this period of kind of a withdrawal, you know, where the child will get cranky and frustrated and I'm bored and there's nothing to do and da 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 da, and you kind of go through this little discharge process. But once you get through that, then it's called, okay, so yeah, you're bored, I hear you, it's kind of hard to hang in there, but I know you'll find something interesting to do eventually. And pretty soon, after a half or an hour or whatever, you know, all of a sudden they sort of snap out of it and, you know, they pick up a coloring book or they go out in the sandbox or they go out and ride their bike or, you know, it's like you have to kind of be willing, though, to go through that little withdrawal period with them and not just jump in. And
yeah, well, I call the video games and television electronic drugs.
So it's a withdrawal process from the electronic drugs.
Sure it is. They're electronic drugs. So some of these things like World of Warcraft and some of these very highly graphic video games that get involved with role-playing games are extremely dangerous. And, of course, Atari came out with these kind of comments from the military research studies done in Texas and elsewhere where they're using them to develop combat models for U.S. military. And the dangers, and this was stated for by senior consultants working with the U.S. military back in the early 80s before they became released to the public as, quote, video games for young people to play with, is that they were concerned that they could, they may not be able to turn off, quote, the kill reflex. And we now have a press, play, and reset kind of culture that people are constantly overstimulating their brains to the point with this multimedia that they that normal sensory input is boring or almost depressive to them because they're high literally on the electronic drugs of this, you know, super high-tech movies. For example, just look at the latest one, you know, Mission Impossible 3. If you look at any of the movies nowadays, there's so much special effects and high action and plots and sub-themes and so on moving so quickly. It's all designed to overstimulate the brain like an electronic drug.
Yeah, so if you take the easy way out and allow your child access to that because you don't want to fight with them or hear them complain or you don't want to, you know, be bothered because it frees them up, it's a great babysitter, and, you know, you end up with this whole process where they're sort of just in a deranged condition and aren't able to, like you say, function in a less stimulating environment or in an academic environment that requires sort of sustained focus and concentration.
Right, and also other kind of like a sustained self-driven imagination, which requires interaction with things like books. So I see more and more people don't read. They just experience in a passive way the input from media, which actually makes the unidimensionality of mind or of thought to be less and less critical, so that the society is more and more like worker bees, and
yeah,
less and less like those that can actually think independently.
So we do what we can to kind of stay aware and challenge, you know, the things and stuff. But we also have to really resist, you know, the allowing ourselves to be constantly overstimulated and busy all the time. You know, we really have to, especially if we have kids. You know, we really have to do whatever it takes to slow down some and just step outside of all that demand and just hang out for a couple hours after dinner doing nothing, you know, as opposed to going right to the computer or going right to the news or, you know, I mean, it's like we really have to do that for ourselves and for our kids, you know.
Yeah, people need to unplug from the system, from what I call free non-scheduled time every day.
Yeah, exactly.
Or they're
going
to lose it. And of course, our whole society is literally addicted to all this electronic world.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, if you turn your life over to television and this electronic world, you really are a lost soul. You really are. You know.
Yeah.
It's easy to do. It's
yeah,
certainly
most
understandable.
Definitely.
But, you know, you're lost, you know, at that point, you know. So, you know, one of the best advice is to, you know, one of the guys I like a lot is a guy named Joseph Chilton Pierce. He's still alive, actually, a child developmentalist kind of guy. You know, he wrote The Magical Child and some other books. But he, you know, his best advice, you know, for the world right now was you know, kind of, you know, reclaim natural childbirth, you know, reclaim breastfeeding, reclaim, you know, really taking care of that early infant attachment period and really create a good, solid, safe space for mothers around all that, you know. And then also, basically, throw away your television, you know, and just, you know, just doing things like that, you know, would make a real big difference.
Yeah, I watch like a couple of minutes of the weather every day and once in a while a documentary. And you have to basically control, just like you have to control your appetite.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I think more people now are addicted electronically than they are to food or anything else. And I don't think people view it as the same level as, quote, electronic, like I do, like electronic drugs. But I really do think that we should use that type of terminology, especially with things that can modify our ways of even thinking about thinking, our ways of responding. And I see this with, you know, impending crises. Like, for example, if the kind of political things that happened with the Bush administration and now the impending nuclear war in the Middle East, 10 years ago, there would be impeachment. When I see the kind of things that happen to society with them trying to do mandatory psychological testing and forced drugging of children, there would be much more outrage and much more political response to it. But I don't see that. I see more and more of a passive society that's very distracted, busy, and completely just addicted to their own little matrix in their own little world, rather than realizing that the bigger issues are, if we don't deal with this corporately, it's going to swallow us up.
Well, that's right. You know, I mean, I am encouraged by the fact that, especially in regards to like the universal mental health screening and the kid drugging and all that, you know, there's a lot of people who come forward, you know, when we talk about those kind of things. You know, there's a lot of people who really get pretty testy when it comes to the idea of government intrusion with their kids and stuff. So obviously,
well, I'm glad
a lot
they started
of people
with...
who accept that passively, but there's also a lot of us who do find a little of that backbone that you're talking about.
Well, I'm glad they started with Texans, because the Texans historically have a little higher measure of backbone than many of the peoples elsewhere in America, and Americans in general, over those in many other countries. I mean, you can say lots of things about America and Americans, but you know, once you start pushing to a certain point, even it may take a little farther now than it did 10 years ago, but still the flashpoint has been reached, whether it's dealing with issues like the marketization of all of these psychoactive drugs to our children, to the spreading plague of insurance carriers and administrative oversight and turning physicians into doc cops, whether it's dealing with pain medicine, psychoactive drugs, or even drugs to lower, let's say, cholesterol. You know, if their model says you better lower it by X number of points, then, of course, it increases the market share for the drugs. And I see this as a, you know, they're going to move from this process of the, you know, the model was there for a long time that if you control the educational system, eventually everything becomes education, whether you're re-educating seniors, you're educating people because they have unacceptable behavior. It's all considered a form of education, and if the outcome isn't what you expect, then there's interventions, whether they're behavioral or pharmacological, that you're going to intervene with.
Well, that's right. I mean, it is a hard thing that Americans are among the most misinformed people in the world for the reasons that you're talking about. You know, the big piece of the good news is that human nature, you know, that doesn't really change as a result of a recent spurt of technological development or whatever, you know, and our nature is basically, as spiritual beings, you know, that we're connected to this, that our nature is basically the same as our creative source, you know, and
right.
My view is that is something that's obviously inclined, it's creative in the sense that, you know, there's constant creation. There's, you know, you take a seed, and how is it that seed becomes an oak tree, you know, or you take a beginning of a little cellular tissue, you know, and how does that evolve into this magnificent human being? I mean, you know, there's this inherent creative energy that is of our source, and that's the nature of our consciousness than our mind. It's also obviously a loving kind of thing, because it's set up in a way that is designed for us to thrive. It's not designed for us to just immediately be destroyed. You know, it's not an unkindly or unloving kind of energy. So our nature is that we're creative, and we're loving, we're tending towards expansiveness. You know, there's an intelligence behind it. And these qualities are ours. You know, and you know, the challenge a lot of times in terms of just the stopping this and stopping that and not doing that, it's really just about clearing out the stuff and that gets in the way of just trusting and allowing our natural intelligence, our natural lovingness, our natural zestful energetic qualities to come forward. And the good news is that's still there, however much it's obscured or covered up.
Oh, absolutely. You know? And yeah, and that's something we need to encourage. We need to have normal, healthy roots. That's why I think that sport, not for worship of the, quote, super sports, but sport for children, physical activity, shutting off the computer. I had one of my son's friends was getting so much into this World of Warcraft, his mother had to take his computer. And, of course, the child had such an outburst that he actually destroyed his computer afterward with a hammer, because his mother wouldn't give it to him, and he finally found it. And of course, she's luckily stood by her gun and said, no, you're not going to get another computer. You know, that's what happens when children get to the point. And then now he's just totally calmed down. He's now going to get into some more outdoor activities and other things. And there is a withdrawal. It's like literally taking someone down off of heroin.
Yeah.
You know, they're addicted. They're addicted to these multimedia and these electronic experiences. And what I'm very concerned about, and, you know, we talked about this in 2006, and I know a lot of classified research projects that literally want to create a cyber world. It's not at all impossible to think 5 or 10 or 20 years from now where, you know, we'll be arguing with our children over issues like, you know, hey, I want to get the latest brain interface chip, you know, so I don't have to have a computer keyboard. I just need an interface with a main database and, you know, be able to get a password to go directly into the cyber world. And people say that's impossible. It's not at all. And these are issues we need to talk about now so in 5, 10, or 20 years' time, we don't have these social catastrophes happening where people literally unplug from the world completely, because we see it in steps happening today.
Well, it's going to be a lot easier to resist that to the extent that people have achieved some sort of remembrance of what I was just talking about, you know. And I mean, because, you know, I mean, a person who's basically experiencing loving, experiencing creative expression in their life, you know, experiencing what it's like to really be close and connected with people, you know, to really be enjoying the connection with the natural world, you know, there's not going to be this sort of mindless desperation to be stimulated all the time or to have whatever, you know, Madison Avenue tells you you need in order to be happy. You know, there's going to be more like, oh, well, that's interesting or whatever, but, you know, my life is rich, you know, and
Yeah, exactly.
I feel loving, you know. I don't need a chip in my brain, you know. I've already got this spirit that's flowing and abundant and seems to be able to manifest when I have an intention about something that's really true for me. I seem to be able to create it and make it come true, you know. That's real magic, you know.
Exactly, and that's why I always say on this show on Clay and Iron that if we knew what we were, we wouldn't do what we do. We have to realize we're a spiritual being, we're a mind that's an amazing instrument, and we also are a physical being. And as a result, if we don't understand that reality of what we are in terms of a creative and evolving being interacting corporately with others and our world, then we won't grasp the fact of why we develop social problems, behavioral issues that are, quote, we become intolerant of, or even of other cultures. A lot of the problems right now in the world is caused by that level of contrived intolerance as a part of a dialectic to create conflict so that some individuals and groups can gain power positions over the others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's concerning to me, and that's why the solution is simply to talk about these things and saying, no, the solution isn't electroshock, it's not drugs, it's, you know, getting rid of those four T's, toxic relationships, toxic lifestyle, toxic nutrition, and toxins in general, whether it's electronic toxins from television or electromagnetic pollution or dealing with detoxification. So, of course, I like to get a psychologist like yourself involved with these kids right off the bat and not a psychiatrist. I like to get them on doing functional testing like QIG or quantitative EEG with a trained psychologist. I like to get them on bicameral exercises to stimulate both sides of their brain,
mm-hmm.
biofeedback to increase coherence patterns, which is basically one area of the brain talks to the other area at equivalent speeds. Look on and improving their nutrition, get rid of, you know, as they say, if you can't pronounce it, don't eat it. Whole foods, organic diet,
mm-hmm.
detoxify with things like a liquid zeolite, alkalinize their body with more vegetables, fruit, and green. Things like barley green and so on. Many, many ways you can do to try to change these kids. And, of course, Dr. Alex Schoss discovered this many years ago at the Biosocial Research Institute in Tacoma, Washington, where in the prison systems they just took the snack machines and put in healthy snacks, and they cut down the, quote, criminal and behavioral disorders in the prisons by 83%.
Wow, yeah.
So, you know, this has been known for many years, but it's not percolating through. And then we have the latest abomination, which is, oh, we're going to get rid of all the sugar stuff, but we're going to stick in, quote, you know, sugar-free snacks. I mean, yeah, really, what kind of behavior are you going to have in schools? And, of course, to maintain behavior, especially with the incidents like Columbine, they're becoming locked down prison-type facilities. And that's what is particularly concerning, along with this, you know, new policy of mandatory psychological testing. It's very similar to the, you know, the dialogues in the book 1984 that, you know, that, you know, that the televisions could literally not just scan your expression, but also know the telltale signs of your heartbeat and other physiological parameters that would indicate that you're, you know, you're hiding something or you're guilty of some form of think-speech type of crime.
Well, this whole lockdown mentality that you're talking about, you know, it's you know, I'm involved in helping some people start up a place for kids here in Austin, you know, and there's a lot of pressure, you know, from some of the relevant juvenile places and all that to make it a lockup, because that's just the whole mentality, you know, and there's just a real distrust of people and of children, you know, and my one of my fundamental teachings, and it's related to what I was saying about sort of clearing out all the other stuff and then remembering our true nature. It's like it's called trusting, you know, that you can trust your children, you know, that you can trust that if they have a need, that's a real need and not a manufactured need, like for a neon cell phone or something, but a real need, like for somebody to listen to them or for some affection or for some exercise or for some food or for anyway, something that's a real need, that you can trust that, you know, and
right.
You don't have to control it and shape it and whatever, but you really can meet your child's needs and they will turn out wonderfully, you know, and you can relax about it, but trust, you know, you don't have to lock them up and punish them and control them, you know, communicate with them, listen to them, figure out what's going on. They want to be close, you know. They want things to go well, and if that's not showing up, it just means that there's some turbulence there that they need a little help with, you know.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, the turbulence of transitions in various stages of their life.
Yeah
exactly.
They're,
those life changes, those periods of intervals where they're going from one stage to another are hormonal. And again, many of these other factors that we mentioned are important for them to
kind of
look at.
Doesn't mean they have a mental illness that you got to worry about that's going to turn them into a pathological killer, you know, or whatever. It just means that, yeah, you got to communicate and figure it out. And but trust, you know, trust yourself, trust your kids, you know, really, really, because we really are, you know. I mean, we're all having a hard time in some ways, you know. The world is in peril. That's the reality, you know. Faith.
Well, I think the peril is manufactured, as they say. The price of oil per barrel is expensive, but the price of fear is many multiple times higher per barrel.
Well said. Yeah.
And, you know, fear is a commodity now, and it's now becoming the international commodity du jour. Instead of the gold standard, it's the oil standard. It's now the fear standard.
Yeah, because people who are afraid, you know, they don't think as well and they don't relate as well. They're a lot easier to manipulate, and so that's one of our biggest responsibilities is to just, you know, deal with our own fears, you know. And
they say the largest growing service industry in the next 10 years in America is the fear industry. Homeland Security, policing, for psychological and other services, lockdown facilities, you know, pharmaceuticals that are developing new things, vaccines to change behavior, like stop addictions.
Well, what is intense fear called? You know, it's called terror, right?
Yeah.
And what are we in? You know, we're in the war on terror. You know, it's like it's being massively promoted and thrown in our face every day. It's the major sort of logo or theme of our society. You know, it's like, you got it, man. And that has that, if you're not able to face that one down,
yeah, that's why when I see psychological, and this is a good question I'm going to ask you today about this, can transition to this. How do young people deal with the fear of things like knowing we have a president who is hell bent on a nuclear war, knowing children deal with, you know, kind of, you know, things that are bigger than life issues like depleted uranium, or, you know, 9/11, Oklahoma City, and you know, Columbine. How do children cope with all these things? And again, that changes the way they look at things. And what I see happening is what I call the cobra in the kitchen phenomena, where, you know, the first time you see the cobra, you scream, but you know, when it's the 10th time, you act like the cobra doesn't even exist. I see this with this show that's going to be shown tomorrow night on ABC, about the avian flu, rather than us doing actual concrete steps to do simple, straightforward, and non-violating of civil rights movements towards a solution to these issues, I see the terror of big shows like this, you know, stacking the bodies and doing all these things. But there's no solutions. I see nothing. Now, I don't see FEMA. I don't see the corporations. I don't see anybody other than the president saying, well, you know, you should be preparing. But no concrete steps. Now, we do have on our website the First Line Defense Kit, and I'm working with Major Frank Stoltz on the chemical and nuclear checklist, which we have on NutriMedical.com, that you can go back in the Learning Center. But these are real simple things, and we just volunteered. We just said, look, we're good American citizens. We just want to do the right thing. Instead, what we have is I call these dialectics of they terrorize the public, say that they're doing something, which is nothing, and then people go into a deeper state of what I call paralysis and inaction. And I see that on a sociological level, too, both with what's happening in our society and how people are working faster and faster for more things. But I see it in terms of people not even being able to perceive the options they have to actually solve the problem, even when we hand the solution to them. Like, here's what you can do to protect your town, your city, your home, your business. And people aren't doing it because they're almost in a state of paralytic fear.
Well, I think your analysis is quite astute, and there is that paralytic fear and apathy that a lot of people experience. My own kids, my view is that little kids need to just be protected from all that. You know, they need to be
protected from
seeing the news. They don't need that. They need to be seeing the world and seeing the trees and the water and letting themselves develop without all that input and stimulation and stuff, you know. So they need to be protected from that, and also they need to be around adults who are pretty relaxed and not all stressed out around all that.
Right.
Now, kids, like my kids are teenagers, and so they're very aware, and, you know, I think the most important thing probably is that there's role models for them, you know, of adults who are able to face reality but not get totally freaked out about it, but do things, but say that, look, yeah, the world's got a lot of problems, it's real, you know, but some of us are working and doing our very best to do what we can, and modeling that, you know. And then my own kids, you know, they see me and they're pretty aware, and they know we have a very irrational and dangerous government and like that, but at the same time, they are very engaged in their own social lives and learning lives, and they haven't really. They support me and they get a little bit involved in things, but mostly they're sort of still developing themselves and their resources, and I try to let them see some of what I do to them. I try to tweak them a little bit occasionally with an awareness about the possible scope of the fraud of things, you know. But I don't push them.
Oh, you can't. Yeah, you want them to kind of gradually engage at their pace,
right.
but mainly lead by example without making it becoming an overwhelming obsession.
Right.
In other words,
my three teenagers,
yeah.
You know, my oldest one gets kind of down sometimes because he's older, and so he's kind of stepping out in the world and confronting things some. But for the most part, they manage to be pretty happy and successful most of the time, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, they see it by
example,
like they see you coping with the world and with issues, but not disengaging. What I want to see is a healthy engagement, but not an obsession.
Right.
I want to see a healthy response by the public to these issues, which can be done without becoming an obsessed kind of maniac that's running around but not accomplishing anything.
Yeah, and that's hard to do, you know. I mean, I have to constantly take my own inventory, and, you know, I got a pretty sensitive nervous system. I get pretty easily aroused, and, you know, I can get strung out pretty easily, you know.
Well, yeah, the thing is that the people that respond to these issues are what I call sensitive people, but at mm-hmm. the same time, they have to maintain balance. And, again,
exactly.
That's the spiritual side of this as well, is that...
Exactly.
We live in a world that's literally trying to shock us. Literally, it's not just electroshock. Everything's
exactly.
shocking.
Yeah.
It's a shocking world, if you want to call it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, everything, you know, from our behavior and our jobs to the educational system to our travel to work and play to everything, you know, is a shock. I mean,
a lot of people are going around in shock, literally. I mean,
right.
It's like, you know, that's where you get that paralyzed thing. You get that sort of numbed out. You get that inability to sort of be aware and present and creative and flexible in the moment because you're living out of some sort of past shutdown state. Yeah, and it has to be, and so part of it is that we have to do what we can to kind of make it safe for each other to come out of shock and to.
So,
you know.
How do people contact you to support you and in your work? You know, either in America or worldwide, how do they get a hold of you again? Let's go through the websites and your phone numbers.
Okay, the websites for the electroshock stuff, it's endofshock.com.
Right.
Endofshock.com. My own website is wildestcolts.com.
That's wildestcolts.
.com.
Yep.
And anybody who really needs to contact me, you know, my public phone number, you know, for my office is area code 512-799-3610.
That's 512-799-3610.
Yeah. And my book's on my website, and also you can access email to me personally through my website or to our through wildestcolts.com or through or regarding the electroshock through the endofshock.com.
Tell us about the books. What's the content, and what will people get when they read these
books?
I've
got two books that are kind of oriented for adults, parents, and other adults in terms of how to think about and work with young people. One is The Wildest Colts Make the Best Horses, which I mentioned, and the other is called True Nature and Great Misunderstandings. And it's a little bit related to what we were talking about in the sense of remembering the true nature of our children and recognizing some of these great misunderstandings, such as that of biological psychiatry. It's a pretty good book. Those are both profiled on the website. And then I've got a big one that's kind of oriented towards psychiatry as a whole and the human transformation process as a whole. It's called The Necessity of Madness and Unproductivity. And that's on the website as well. You can see that. I've got a little ebook that's available called Eyes Wide Open. It's basically all about sort of how to confront reality, you know, and not be in denial about it and kind of how that works psychologically and stuff.
Yeah, because, in fact, I consider a true optimist someone who can face reality squarely, the beauty and the ugliness of it, and then respond in a healthy way to have a positive outcome or options.
And that is an incredible accomplishment, but that's really what we need to do.
Yeah, we need to build those skills into our children. And I see that the current either educational system or the parenting system, because people are so stretched, a lot of it by their own choice. I mean, they turn on the TV, they don't go for walks together, they don't do these other things. As a result, they disconnect with their close family members, their, you know, personal relationships, and with their communication. They say a family that communicates X number of minutes. One of my good questions when I'd ask whether there was a marital problem in the family or problems with their children, I asked how many minutes a day did they talk to their children or their wife or husband.
Mm-hmm.
And that was almost a better scale than almost anything else, because if they talked, even if it was a negative talk, at least it was some kind of dialogue going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave me a yardstick to kind of get an idea of, okay, now we can figure out whether these are healthy or unhealthy dialogue, but then at least if there's discussion going on, we've got a platform to work from.
Yeah, that's great, Bill. I think the whole communication thing, you know, I mean, if you just choose one thing to work on, you know, it's just really working on communicating, you know, being able to communicate the truth as best you can in a way that people can receive it, and on the other end, being able to receive any communication, you know, to be able to really be open to, you know, receiving. And so, yeah, communicating, you know, our world has developed in a way that people are alienated and isolated, and it really is a challenge to be in community with each other. That's a great one.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. So, now, what are the latest things happening? What's the timeline of the discussions you're going to have, the conferences, the events coming up, not only in Texas but across America? What's coming up in the next few months?
Well, my personal biggest thing right now is with this electroshock thing. You know, we're in dialogue with the hospital. You know, we did our first public event a couple of weeks ago. That was a pretty good rally outside the hospital. We're doing afterwards with that, with our little videos and stuff like that, and then we're going to mobilize for a bigger rally to follow. That's a local thing, but we have the resources on the website and you know, and the energy to really support people who want to take on that particular issue in their community. That's the end of shock.com. Now, in terms of the children's stuff, that is not going away, unfortunately, anytime soon. And
you're talking about the children's drugs. You mean.
The children's drugging and the New Freedom stuff, and that's
isn't that amazing? They call it New Freedom.
That's a likely state by state thing.
Yeah.
In Texas, you know, it's gearing up again next year. We've got a big thing right now around so-called school finance, and the governor's political life is in jeopardy if he doesn't get that handled, and so everything else is on the back burner. But around the country, you know, awareness about this New Freedom stuff. The guy who has the Teen Scream website, Ken Kramer, that's a really good guy to plug into as far as challenging this whole mental health screening thing. You can just Google Teen Scream, and you know, his website will be one of the top two to show up.
What shows up? What's on the website?
It's basically all about the reality of what this screening stuff is about, the political actions around it, you know, different initiatives, just a lot of information and support and a way to kind of plug into that network around challenging the mental health.
Right. Does he cover things like the actual development of the protocols by companies?
Yeah, he's got some of that. He's got actual examples of some of the instruments. Ken Kramer, he's just the guy who sort of pulled it out. There's other really good sites around too, but he's the guy who sort of pulled this together better than anybody that I can find.
Yeah, it's nice to connect the dots, which is why I like in our program, both on the Nutramedical Report on Genesis, GCN Live, and here on BBS Radio. It's so important to connect all the dots. We talk about all kinds of different issues, but we want people, if they listen to the shows or listen to the archives, they'll start to connect the dots, and eventually it'll all come. They'll see not only the trees, but they'll see the forest and the trees. And when they do that, they'll start to say, aha, there is a solution to this problem, but it requires a completely different way of thinking about whether there even is a problem or just a different way of looking and perceiving what's going on.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you being on tonight's program. Dr. Breeding, I have to commend you for your persistence and your bravery. And, of course, you know, the comments that Tom Cruise, I totally agree with him, by the way. And I don't know if he's listening or any of his people are listening to this program. I want them to know that I really appreciate when celebrities stand up because, you know,
I do too.
When we have things like that happen, people need to stand up. And I'd like to hear more of my doctor colleagues get a backbone. You know, if they need a backbone transplant, call me and I'll give them one free.
There you go.
Because they need to start standing up, and they shouldn't be afraid of regulatory authorities. Or regulatory authorities, like the government says, should be afraid of our citizens. When regulatory authorities become a power unto themselves, and they're using hegemony to enrich a small subclass, then they are no longer of any use to either themselves or anyone else.
Yeah, and I'm like you. I appreciate, you know, people who are willing to put themselves out and tell the truth, and like Tom Cruise did. And,
oh yeah.
And I appreciate just continuing to call your colleagues forward, you know, and to challenge them to be more truthful and more courageous. You know, there's those who are just overtly dishonest, and there's others who are just kind of timid and absorbed in their own, and you're challenging them both.
Well, the thing is, the medical profession could throw off the yokes. It's almost like you want to call it when Semmelweis, the Hungarian physician, decided to have people wash their hands rather than being covered with blood doing surgical procedures. We need to do the same thing in psychiatry. Take off your bloody garments, wash your hands, make sure you have clean hands when you're looking at the toxic relationships, nutrition, world, GMO foods, electromagnetic pollution, television, cultural pollution, etc., everything else that's going on, and the lack of communication, and then look at the true issues instead of just taking kids and say, look, we have a disruptive kid, they have ADD, put them on drugs, or we'll take the children away from you. And we've got to start changing it from this kind of very, what I call, the Nazification of medicine.
Well, I've certainly learned some just in these couple of hours listening to you. I really enjoy it. You've obviously thought deeply about a lot of things, you know. And the truth, you know, I forget who said it, but, you know, it's the idea that you put the truth out and at first it's ignored and then it's ridiculed and then it's obvious that it's true.
Of course it is. And again, the thing is, you can only do that if you have passion. And I'm particularly concerned not only about these crazy drugs, but also the crazy vaccines that are coming down the pike, too. And I want to say this preemptively, don't. In fact, I'm going to have on the Nutramedical Report this Thursday, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and we're going to be talking about all. There's 200 vaccines in the Operation BioShield. Many of these are what we call psychoneurotronic vaccines that create nanoplaque on specific nerve pathways to alter behavior. And again, it's the same bad boys involved, the big mega transnational corporate giant pharmaceutical companies that are behind all this. And, of course, vaccination becomes a mandatory thing under, again, this new freedom and all the other things that they say are going to be our new freedoms we're going to have. I think I'd like to have my old freedom back, please. I don't want any new freedom.
Freedom is coming.
Yeah, exactly. Coming. Well, thanks freedom very much for being so, gracious to give us a two-hour program because I wanted to cover the whole breadth of these topics. And again, stay tuned to the Clay and Iron Show. We're going to have some amazing guests coming up in the next days, weeks, and months. And we'll definitely have to have you back on, Dr. Beeding, because I want to hear how this progress goes with your hospital there in Austin, Texas. Now, tomorrow night we have actually Mark Hazelwood, and we're going to be talking about the solar activity around the issue that we call Planet X. Now, you might want to dismiss this, but I tell people always keep an open and a critical mind. And this is what we want people to do, keep an open and critical mind, is what's going on with things like chemtrails and things like that. And then we're going to have Dr. Betty Martini talking about aspartame coming up on Wednesday the 10th. Next week we have Lone Lantern, 9/11 Truth Movement, Gary Franchi. And on Tuesday, we have Sherry Edwards talking about sound health. And again, next Wednesday, we have Steve Kuser. And we're going to be talking about the avian flu. Now, of course, there's a special coming up tomorrow night. And don't just go into a paralytic state of fear. Talk to your children, you know, if they're older children. Talk to your friends. Don't just go into a state of paralysis over all this fear because they're marketing fear so they get control. And don't do that. Don't let it ruin your nervous system and your health. See the flowers, breathe the fresh air, go for a walk, and don't immerse yourself in the electronic pollution. Thank you for listening to the program, and thank you, Dr. John Breeding. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill.
Take care, everyone, and thank you, Don and Doug over at BBS Radio.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.